Welcome to Open Gym, a weekly podcast bringing you the best ideas of the brightest minds in the gym business. My name is Patrick Cummings. I'm a brand coach to entrepreneurs and change makers, a longtime CrossFitter, and your host. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. This week on the show, I'm excited to bring you a conversation with John Feinman. John is the founder and CEO of Inner City Weightlifting in Boston, Massachusetts. After spending some time in the AmeriCorps, while John was getting his MBA from Babson College, he studied how weight training could be used to elevate the prospects of people too often written off by society. Inner City Weightlifting began not long after, and today, 10 years later, the organization's mission is to reduce gun violence by amplifying the voice and agency of people who have been most impacted by systemic racism and mass incarceration. John and I talk about the four stages of their impact model, how they work to empower those in their program to earn the skills necessary to become personal trainers, and his advice to gym owners who want to do their part in making a similar difference in their community. I start the conversation by asking John why he thought there was such potential in using weightlifting as a bridge to the work he was hoping to do.
Initially, I mean, it was completely naive of me, actually. I thought in 2010, when we got off the ground, that we were going to get people into the Olympics, the college athletic scholarships, and weightlifting, specifically the sport of weightlifting, that it was somehow going to solve problems of individuals. Very quickly, I learned and we learned that just wasn't going to work. We had people who were shot and paralyzed. We had people going in and out of jail. We had people just worried about where they're going to sleep that night. The idea that weight training was going to solve someone's problems was everything a white guy from Amherst, Mass. Would think could work. or the idea that somehow the Olympics or a college athletic scholarship should be the goal. But we were really committed from the beginning to working with people who had faced systemic racism and were up against mass incarceration, and those same systems of oppression had led to street involvement. What was working was not weight training, but the excuse that weight training gave us to reach out to people that society otherwise tells us to avoid. Mm-hmm. To send a text saying, hey, I'm working out at 3 o'clock today, you want to join? Mm-hmm. And that started to give way to this four-stage model we have today. Four stages being trust, hope, bridging social capital, and finally economic mobility. And the gym gave us that reason to reach out, to start a conversation, to prove ourselves and earn someone's trust. Mm-hmm. And that gave us a place to deepen those relationships, to broaden community, to put more options on the table, to become partners with an individual so that they don't necessarily feel like they have to solve their problems alone. Mm-hmm. So that they can lean on additional people and communities for help with something as simple as getting an ID, getting safe transportation. And then the career track and personal training, while initially the purpose there was economic mobility, we realized something more important was happening. This kind of set the vision for the organization going forward. And that was this bridging of social capital and this flipping mm-hmm. of power dynamics that would happen. And we realized that it wasn't just the people in our program getting access to new networks and opportunities, which is great. But more important, they were becoming the expert, not just in fitness, but in the social issues they've lived. And just like what Alexin and some of his friends had done for me, they're changing people's worldviews. And that value of networks, it's not just going one way. It's not that people in our program should feel so lucky to be able to network with more affluent people. In mm-hmm. fact, it's the opposite. It's more affluent people who may not have ever known anyone's been to jail before this, that someone who has faced the struggles that people in our program have been able to overcome, the value that they get, that I get from getting to know someone, it's just incredible. And it changes, I think, certainly the way I see the world, the way I move through life, and feel lucky to be on this journey together with the people in our program.
I'd love to at least get a better sense or a little bit of a better sense of these four stages that you mentioned, and I'll just repeat them. The first is to earn trust. The second is to build hope. The third is social capital. And the fourth is economic mobility. Can you maybe just walk us through what each one of those stages looks like and maybe a little bit of how you developed it as a model?
Probably about 6 months into the pilot in 2010, we got a phone call from the superintendent of police at the time and asking a few questions about, you know, do we actually know who we're working with? I'm like, I think I do. I think we do. And the second question was, you know, how do you get people you're working with to the gym? And you know, I just kind of nonchalantly said, we drive them. And it blew people's mind. It was something so simple. And what I realized in that first year, talking with people from the outside looking in, talking with potential funders, we always like to think, generally speaking, as a society, that, you know, education, careers, we should all look, talk, and think the way the quote-unquote elite in the U.S. do and follow their perspective and their footprints and their path. And I can't even remember how many times I was told what people need. Me being a white person from Amherst, I recognized early on, I have no clue what I'm doing. The only chance we have at success, that I have at success, is to listen. Mm-hmm. And quickly, I began this journey of learning much more about the history of this country, the very uncomfortable history of this country. And, you know, I say uncomfortable, I'm fortunate that I haven't had to live it the way people in our program have. And kind of learned that that first stage of trust, the reason why so few organizations are working with a lot of the people that are in our program, with our trainers, it's not necessarily because they don't want to. It's because they're set up from a perspective that doesn't fit the reality of where people in our program are coming from. And oftentimes, society, from the day someone's born onto a street that we are literally told to avoid, people know that that's happening, whether they know it explicitly or not. And it leads to this understandable distrust, especially when you look at the historical context of how and why that has happened. And so I learned early on that if we were to do this work, it was on me, it's on us to earn the trust of the people we're going to work with and not the other way around. And I think that was a really important flip in the traditional way of thinking. Someone doesn't have to earn our program. Who are we to even say that? We have to earn their trust in us. And then the second stage, hope, that really came out of conversations with funders who would very quickly jump to talking about education and careers. Mm-hmm. Anyone wants an education or a career. The problem is when it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs and you're focused on the struggles of today just to get through and see tomorrow, it becomes really hard to prioritize these aspects that anyone might want. Mm-hmm. But don't happen for a number of months or years. And so we realized that if we were going to be talking with funders and raising money, that we had to, in collaboration with the people in our program, educate people and be on this much more honest journey that talked about these fundamental issues, like picking someone up and getting them to the gym and driving them home so they can just get there safely. And so that's really what the hope stage was all about. It's solving those really basic issues. It's anyone in our program, if they don't have an ID, we'll drive someone to the RMV, we'll pay their ID for them. If they need a license, we'll pay for the permit, we'll pay for the license, we'll pay for driving classes. We'll do however many of those fundamental or foundational issues that otherwise stand in the way of being able to focus on educational or career achievement. That third stage, bridging social capital, and we're really careful to phrase it as bridging, again, so that it's seen as this two-way street, not your kind of typical, you know, let's mingle with the rich and try to be more like them. If anything, I actually think affluent people and you, not necessarily affluent, people who don't know or aren't close to the trainers in our program, you know, especially as you see events unfold across this country. Mm-hmm. We as a society have so much to learn. And the reason why I say we have so much to learn from trainers and people in this program is that historically we've devalued. And if we're learning from someone, now we are by nature valuing their input. And so that bridging of social capital is really important, it combined with the fact that what we saw is that, you know, jobs come and go. And it really comes down to who's around you, who's your support network. I look at our organization in the wake of COVID-19. The reason why we've actually been successful and are growing is because of the strength of our network and the support we have around us. If we didn't have that, if we didn't have that social capital, you know, March 23rd hits and all of a sudden we're looking at a devastating year. And that is true for individuals as well. So that stage was probably the most important evolution of this organization, in addition to obviously economic mobility. But the reason why I say that the bridging social capital stage was so important is that it created a new vision for the organization, that we're going to stay as focused as ever on our core services and what we do well. At the same time, by growing these core services, we also create a platform to amplify the voices and agency of the people in our program who have so much to teach all of us and sadly have been devalued by society the first time they were labeled a criminal, the first time they were on a street that we were all told to avoid, and sadly, because of systemic racism and the color of someone's skin. And this opportunity to have a platform where we value people now. And that's not about me. It's not even about the organization. It's about each person as an individual leveraging this platform however they want to for themselves. So that stage was really important in setting up where we want to go as an organization.
What does economic mobility mean in the context of what you guys do?
For us, and we had a professor, this must have been 2013, start to come in and do some research all willingly with people in our program. Obviously, we didn't force anyone. And I saw some of the initial findings, and more than 80% of the people in our program come from family incomes of less than $10,000 per year. So for us, economic mobility is simply $30,000 or more. And hopefully a lot more than that. But then there's also these really incredible moments that happen in the journey to get there or once someone has surpassed that. And the number of people we've had in the program that have taken their first vacation ever, that got on a plane for the first time, that had an experience that, you know, certainly someone like myself took for granted growing up and taking two vacations a year and little weekend trips. So that stage is more than just about how much money someone's making. It's about living. It's about having housing that is safe and stable and sustainable. It's about being able to afford the luxury of time, of space, of vacations, and being able to set that future that I think, you know, I certainly take for granted every day. But you look at what a lot of the people in our program have overcome and continue to try to overcome. You know, the future is not guaranteed the same way. Mm-hmm.
I'd love to get kind of specific about what that economic mobility looks like. As my understanding, and correct me if I'm only getting this half right, is that folks who go through your program can then have the option of basically becoming a personal trainer, and then they can earn income by training other people from within your gym. Is that roughly correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Initially, we actually thought we were just going to get people certified. We get them placed at other gyms. We actually had an internship or job shadowing program set up at a high-end gym in Boston. We had two people there. It was actually going really well. And then one of the members of this gym complained about an ankle bracelet being on one of the people in our program, one of our trainers. Mm-hmm. And that killed that job shadowing program. And we also realized, for me, again, very much naively, that people and organizations that they weren't going to overlook someone's criminal record. And I think at this point, we all know how flawed the criminal justice system is. So at that point, we actually decided to open up our own gyms and start training our own clients. And we're at a point now, actually, where we're in our 11th year and we've been able to develop some partnerships. So now there is a lot more internal and external job placement. But again, to hit on that bridging social capital stage, it's not just jobs in fitness. We had the managing director of a Toyota dealership hire 17 people from our program over the course of 2 years. Wow. We had the CEO of a tech company hire 2 people from our program to run their cafe. We've had other students who get stuck in a job interview process, not because the interview didn't go well, but because of the query. And we've had a client in our gym who knows someone at these institutions and organizations who calls the head of that department, and the next day the job goes through. And that's really how we've been able to leverage community, this family that we now have at ICW.
It feeds into one of the questions I wanted to ask, which is getting a sense from you just what the business model actually looks like. What does that look like? Is it roughly what it looked like, you know, 10 years ago when you started? Has it evolved? And if so, how has it evolved?
It's evolved a lot since we first started. We first started, again, it was going to be like a college readiness and Olympic development program. It was an organization and a business model that just simply was not going to work. But from the beginning, our core mission was to work with and listen to people in our program, to people where during that year of AmeriCorps, I just saw this giant void in organizations willing or that could with this specific population. So at that point, we turned from simply a weight training program to a workforce development program. And as that started to happen, I kind of explained how we evolved to eventually having our own gyms and having our own personal training that can happen within our gyms and generating our own clients that our trainers are able to train even before they're nationally certified so they can make some money and get some hands-on experience while they're still studying. And then in 2015, when we opened up our gym in Kendall Square, it was due to 2 things. One, we had enough trainers ready that we wanted to set up in an area where they could make a substantial amount of money, mm-hmm. just based on being a gym in an area that could support hundreds of personal training clients. Second, it was to test out at the time this hypothesis that perhaps the biggest impact of our model, of our program, was not the impact on the people in it. It was the impact of the people in our program, of our trainers, on society. And we quickly saw the power of that. We heard stories of our personal training clients talking about racism with their friends when they otherwise would have turned away from an otherwise thorny topic and not have the courage or the knowledge, I should say, to want to be vulnerable in those conversations and to try to move the needle forward. We had other people who are high up at companies who at first were hesitant, who now lead racial equity and criminal justice reform issues within their companies because they had, similar to me, that experience and that could shift your worldview from knowing an individual and not mm-hmm. seeing a problem through a lens of statistics and probability, but through the certainty of a singular individual's experience. Mm-hmm. And it just humanizes it. It makes mm-hmm. it so that we don't look at these issues through a lens of criminality, but instead through a lens of humanity. And at that point, you actually start getting somewhere. Mm-hmm. So that's very much kind of the evolution of our business model as it relates to impact, giving a more typical, I guess, kind of grad school business answer. The business model is we're about 75% revenue coming from philanthropy,
yep.
combination of individual donors, corporate partners, either through foundations or sponsorship, and foundations. And then the remaining 25% is earned income from our training services. Most of that money, though, really just passes through us and creates jobs and income for people mm-hmm. in our program on top of the jobs that we hire our trainers and students for just to help run the gym.
is the vision of the future one where that balances out a little more? In other words, maybe there's 2 gyms, 6 gyms, 10 gyms, or do you get the sense from your experience that's probably going to be the split and then that's okay?
It's a great question. I have apparently all I do is give nuanced answers.
Those are my favorite kinds. So it's okay.
Clearly, I'm not the data guy around here. I don't live in numbers. And the reason why it's nuanced is that my belief, our belief is that as our training services grow, if we're giving individual clients and our corporate clients, this is where training companies like John Hancock, like Boston Consulting mm-hmm. Group, Philips, Sage, Drift, several other companies. If we're doing that well, every person, every company that trains with us is a potential donor. Mm-hmm. And as they become pulled into not just the service we offer and valuing that, obviously in and of itself is great, but they also now can help with the social mission. And so as that earned revenue goes up, if we're doing our job right, so too should that philanthropic revenue from mm-hmm. people we're training. And obviously not everyone who trains with us is going to donate, but certainly a significant percentage. And as we're training companies, you know, a lot of these companies, they're without having looked at their balance sheet or P&L, they've got some money to spend. So I kind of see the two growing very much hand in hand. Maybe it evens out a little bit and ends up somewhere around kind of 60-40 or 70-30. But mm-hmm. the two should really be feeding into the growth of each other.
And I imagine we're, for better or worse, the times that we're all in currently, I imagine that you guys are set up to have these conversations maybe better than a lot of other people are. How are you trying to lean into the times to make sure that you are having the impact that you've always wanted to have? And again, it sounds crazy, but how are you kind of taking advantage of the national conversation that we're all kind of in the midst of in an effort to, like I said, continue that impact, continue that growth?
First and foremost, for me, not having lived it, you know, I'm fortunate to get to be with a lot of people in our program day in, day out in the gym. So first and foremost, I listen to people in our program. You know, anything we do, strategy, anything we say, it has to be genuine to the people we're working with. It has to be done with their approval. So to start, the way we kind of lean into these times is listening. It's finding the ways to be a part of this much larger movement and cause that honors our trainers, that honors mm-hmm. people starting in our program. And it again, kind of doubles back to this vision of the more we grow our core services and intentionally set our organization up as a platform for the people in our program to be heard, to be valued, mm-hmm. to be the thought leaders and experts that they rightfully so have earned and are. That's how we go about it. And the Monday after George Floyd's his being murdered by a police officer, I came into the gym, and at that point we still weren't officially open, but we have been doing virtual training sessions. So we had a few of our trainers in here just accessing the space to put on those virtual training sessions. And the sessions that I saw and heard, people weren't working out. They were asking questions of their trainer. And I just thought that was incredible, because in any other setting, this person has been deemed by society to be a violent gang member. That was literally just said as 30 people in Boston were arrested. They were called violent gang members, reducing them to a simple statistic, an easy to swallow narrative, and not an appreciation for context. And what happens when we label someone a gang member, a criminal? It's ways to rationalize this devaluing of someone. And not look at them as a singular individual. And so what I saw in those moments with our personal training clients, asking these questions about these issues that are hitting people in the gut. It was valuing someone, not as a professional personal trainer, but as an expert in these social issues that we as a society have to do so much more listening, learning, and valuing of people that we have found every reason to not value. And so that was just incredible. And that to me is how we lean into these times. It's not about, you know, if the organization grows, great, but it's about being genuine to the people in our program and doing everything we can to support, to partner in the ways that they want.
How do you think about expanding the, not expanding in the sense of growth and more gyms and more philanthropy and all that, but how do you think about expanding the mindset that you guys have developed there as it relates to, like you said, a population that are too often written off? Because I'm thinking about gym owners who are listening, whose interest might be piqued, who might be wondering what they could do, even in their own small way, to affect the kind of change that you guys are doing on a larger scale. Where might you point them? What questions might you ask them? What you have them ask? Like, just, is there a place that it would make sense where this kind of idea, this kind of model, this kind of mindset might be able to be implemented in other training environments, perhaps separate from you or in collaboration with you?
I would love to see ICW become part of a broader national movement. And whether that means that we become a national organization or we get other partners or just we teach the model. The mission that we have, the vision that we have, it doesn't work if it's just us. It doesn't work without that growth and that greater platform. So to answer your question, to me, it starts with a willingness to listen and a willingness to act. And I think the challenge with listening is that you can't just pay lip service. You can't just say, oh, I've listened to this person, I now know better. Or I listened to this person, I feel better because I did that. You need to act, but you need to act in genuine ways. And the reason why it's so tricky is that if you don't listen first, you're probably going to act in a way that is well-intentioned, but actually perpetuate what you don't want to have happen.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And so I guess what I would say is, you know, if you're a gym owner and you want to do something, look around where you're located. Looking at most major cities anyway, you've got these streets that we are literally told not to cross. And every time we do that, we're perpetuating systemic racism, we're perpetuating systems of segregation. And I would challenge people to not accept that. It's not to be blind to certain realities, but if you're willing to listen, if you're willing to be genuine, you can start to build relationships. You can start to see your own involvement. And I'll speak to myself. When I first moved to Boston, I was told don't cross certain streets. And I told other people not to do that. I will never say that again because I know people that live on the other side of that street, the quote unquote other side of that street. Whether I like it or not, and in fact, I don't like it, I was participating in systemic racism every time I said that. I had no clue I was doing it. And you know, it's how insidious and subtle this is that a lot of us who mean well, if we're not aware, if we're not willing to listen, if we're not willing to know that we may unintentionally be part of the problem, we're going to continue to be the problem. So this is not a political issue. This is a societal issue. And I do think that personally, gyms are this incredible setting, and especially personal training. And the reason why I say personal training is that, again, using myself as an example, when I was 23, what business did I have telling global leaders at consulting groups, telling Harvard Business School professors, telling CEOs of companies what to do? And yet I did, because I knew something about personal training. I knew something about fitness. And what other setting are the power dynamics flipped like that? You know, any other setting where I'm around the people I was training, I'm there to learn from them. But in this unique setting, they're here to learn from me. And so I think when we combine that with some of these societal issues that stem from just a horrible, horrible history of this country, that stem from devaluing people, from taking, trying to rob people of their voice and agency through the criminal justice system, through systemic racism, through systems of oppression. Personal training naturally breaks all that down and allows these relationships to form that it's hard to find another job, I think, where that really happens. That combination of professionalism and expertise with that level of conversational intimacy that happens over an hour long training session as well. So a long-winded way of saying, I think gym owners have this incredible opportunity, especially through personal training, and you got to find a way to get to know people in genuine ways and start to really get close to the issues and speak with people who are experiencing those issues, not for and not from a misguided perspective.
Thank you to John for the conversation, and to you, as always, for listening. If you want to learn more or support Inner City Weightlifting's mission, a link to their website is in the show notes. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Open Gym wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you have, please leave us a review and consider sharing the show with someone who might find it valuable. Open Gym is part of the Morning Chalk Up Podcast Network. My name is Patrick Cummings. Stay strong, my friends.